Thank you. May it please the court. I'm not going to rehash all the same arguments that I made earlier. I can see the tenor of this court's questions. I want to start off by addressing this notion of statutes which enhance, for lack of a better word, by incorporation of the definition of the offense. The respondent has cited to several examples from the criminal code, first-degree sexual abuse, stealing felonies. They are worded differently than the stealing statute at question here. And our argument was never with the positioning of that enhancing provision, but rather the language of the statute. So, for instance, assault first is described in subsection 1 of, I believe it's 565, I can't remember the exact provision. And then it purports to enhance the felony in subsection 2 by saying, you know, where serious physical injury is caused. Or so that language is clear, and that's how the stealing statute read prior to 2002. One of the things that's sort of been hinted at in this argument is this notion that Bazell created new law and that that to understand there to be no crime, felony of stealing over is somehow a was not a, had been dealt with earlier. But when I was looking at the cases cited by the respondent, the Miller case, the Brown case, the Tivis case, and the Callicott case, Callicott and Tivis are from before 2002. So to the extent that they announced that the value is an element of the offense, they were talking about a statute before amendment. Brown and Miller, I think, to the extent that they rely on Callicott, have that same defect. Indeed, the Miller case referred to the Slocum case, which was a receiving stolen property case. And there might have been this gratuitous comment in Slocum about value being an element of felony stealing, but that was not at issue in the Slocum case. It was definitely receiving stolen property. Judge Fisher, I'm going to try to answer your question.
Thank you.
The simplest reason that I can explain for Ms. Robinson and Ms. Windconnect not having filed these motions is they simply didn't understand the problem with the law at the time that they could have filed an authorized Form 40. These are actually both guilty pleas, so it would have been under Rule 2435. But to suggest that that Rules 2915 and 2435 are language of restriction, I think would do away with habeas altogether. I mean, Ms. Sinia, by that logic, because, or Ms. Sinia, I can't recall the sex, the gender of the person, but Sinia would be stuck imprisoned even though the oral pronouncement differed from the written judgment by virtue of the fact that there had been no authorized motion. So I think habeas is designed to correct these sentencing defects. Even though it's something that might have been raised earlier, there's still a need for habeas.
I think Zinnis said in limited circumstances, the failure to timely raise a claim under 24035 or 2915 doesn't bar subsequent habeas relief. So it's limited circumstances.
Yes, I believe it is limited.
And you're saying one of those circumstances is when the court exercises a power it does not have, acts beyond its authority as a judge.
Right. Right. And I think this is why, for instance, Mr. Mitchell in Koster versus Jackson got relief under habeas, because even though Mitchell had been convicted of the felony form of DWI long before the Turner case came out, the Western District of the Court of Appeals was willing to grant relief despite the fact Mitchell had not filed a post-conviction motion.
Can you address Mr. Sauer's argument that that most substantive changes in the law do not apply retrospectively, they do apply prospectively, and that the clarification exception just applies where it's, it does not apply in this situation because we've had previous authoritative announcements?
Well, let me answer that in part. I think the in two parts. First, the court's reluctance to apply its decisions retrospectively or retroactively is something it has never been shy about saying. It's applied substantive decisions retrospectively or retroactively in the severe case, which was a DWI enhancement case. The rule from which the respondent draws is the statements made in State versus Ferguson, which was considering an issue of direct review, whether the instructions fairly instructed the jury. It was back at the time when there were consolidated appeals, so there may have been issues of post-conviction relief, but it was decided on direct review grounds. And even Judge Limbaugh said at the time, generally, we will not apply these decisions retroactively. But it was the same Judge Limbaugh who wrote the Turner decision, and Mr. Turner came to this court on a post-conviction appeal. So I don't know that there is a hard and fast rule that forever after substantive decisions are going to be prospective only.
That is the basic rule that's applied, is they're prospective unless circumstances exist which make it justice require them to be applied
right. Right, and I think these are just those circumstances. It is, you know, that the court has you know taken a look at the statute in question, decided that the enhancement did not apply to the defendant. I mean, that's why I think even way back in 1994, Judge Limbaugh was saying, you know, generally, leaving open room to decide cases like this.
How do we decide?
What about the 93 case, Simmons versus White, which was a DWI enhancement statute where the court refused to apply habeas?
I think that depends on the facts of that case. I think Mr. Simmons had gotten relief at an earlier juncture and then had come back to the court. He made a conscious waiver, if you will, of his complaint and proceeded in the face of a violation that he later came back and complained about in his habeas petition, if I'm understanding the facts of the Simmons case.
Which could be very similar to a bunch of cases on probation right now. I mean, there could be people on probation for these offenses, and there's no reason for them to file a habeas until their probation's revoked.
Well, indeed, they couldn't. They couldn't file an authorized, you know, post-conviction motion.
Because they're not in custody.
Aren't all the juvenile death penalty cases and life without parole cases which we applied the new rule retroactively, there were substantive decisions saying it's beyond the authority of the courts to impose death or impose life without parole on juveniles, yet they applied to all existing cases, not simply prospectively, because
indeed,
it was beyond the power of the court to act.
And I think those are cases that are, you know, would be beneficial for this court to re-examine. I certainly looked at them again in preparation for this argument. I mean, when there is, fairly substantial announcement from this court. I reject the argument that we've relied on our prior understanding informing charging handbooks and jury instructions. Whenever there's a case that is substantive, it is going to necessarily change the paperwork that we use to administer justice. But that's really putting the cart before the horse. What the court should look at is whether it has announced a new rule. I suggest a new rule, and I'm sort of running with your answer, Judge, but I suggest a new rule is when the court says, well, henceforth, we're declaring a rule of evidence, or we're invalidating a particular pattern jury instruction. the court can only clarify the law. I mean, what the court did in Mazzell was they clarified the law. And whether they did so after 10 examinations or one, I don't think makes a difference to this court's ability to apply it.
Help me understand where you draw the line between clarifying the law and stating a new rule.
Well, I mean, a new rule would be, I would understand a rule as being sort of procedural in nature. A new rule, you know, what we thought was inadmissible, we now decide is admissible. Or what we decide about whether lesser included offenses should be.
I think the question may be clarifying the law versus making a substantive change in the law, not talking about procedure.
Well, I think whenever the law is clarified, that's substantive in nature. So I don't know that I would necessarily draw a line or distinguish it between a substantive decision and one.
I just was trying to decide how that would be articulated so that it would give guidance as to how do we define clarifying the law versus a change in the law.
Would you have any to tail on that? Iowa Supreme Court in the Ghostman case said a change in substantive law which does not clarify existing law but overrides prior authoritative precedents on the same substantive issue. Would you agree with some kind of language like that is used in Iowa?
No, I mean, I wouldn't. I think that if that was the case, then, for instance, Mr. Turner would not have been able to get relief on his post-conviction appeal because the Meigs case had addressed the same issue head-on, I want to say like 13 years before. So I don't know that it necessarily depends on whether particular precedent has been overruled, but it has more to do with whether we have a new understanding of the statute and not necessarily the forms and the way it's administered. I hope that answers it.
You're a little more loose than what Iowa wants to do.
I'm sorry, Judge?
Iowa's a little stronger than what you agree with.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to first address the issue raised by several of the petitioners that Pasley was decided after their convictions were final. And so the law, there's no issue of retroactivity here. But that critically ignores the number of Court of Appeals decisions, Miller, Slocum, Brown, which did hold that this C felony of stealing over $500 is a felony. And courts were relying on those interpretations, and they were bound by those interpretations prior to Pasley and also prior to this court's decision in Bazell. I would also point out that this court issued the approved jury instructions and approved charge language for felony stealing, and in both those documents as well as the notes on use, this court affirmatively stated that the C felony of stealing over $500 is a C felony.
Now, we have found that as hard as everyone tries to make the charging approved charging documents and the MAI correct under the substantive law that they don't control and that they can be erroneous. So Mr. Thompson argues that we should not, the fact that we have jury instructions and have a charging language should not be what determines whether it is valid law or not. Can you respond to that?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor, that sometimes the MAIs and the mockers can be incorrect, but so can sometimes prior case law, as this court found when it overruled Pasley in State v. Bazell. Now, And we also don't have to rely alone on this court's interpretation of the language in the approved jury instructions and in the approved charges, because we have the Pasley decision and the other decisions that have held that stealing is a felony when it's charged as stealing over $500. That's an essential element, and that's what those cases previously held. Those were authoritative judicial interpretations of the question. And as I said, the courts, the state and criminal defendants were all relying on those decisions when they were entering in, when they were entering in these criminal prosecutions.
Can you address my question about cases such as Roper versus Simmons and the LWOP cases, life without parole cases, which the Supreme Court has said do apply retrospectively to everybody who's serving because they're serving a sentence which the courts are not authorized by law to impose, either death or life without parole. In contrast, in Apprendi and Ring, in federal court, they said those are matters of procedure. It's who makes the decision, not a substantive right, and therefore we don't apply it retroactively. I'm not sure how that informs our decision here, but perhaps you can help the court figure that out.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the juvenile life without parole cases, you're correct that this court did apply that retroactively.
And other courts have.
And other courts have also applied that retroactively. That was a substantive decision. And substantive changes in the law can be applied retroactively. However, which we have been left out of the arguments this morning and which counsel for petitioners has critically ignored is that the rule announced in State v. Ferguson is that when a decision of this court which overrules prior precedent and essentially creates new law and that decision is substantive, when that overruling decision is silent as to the decision's retroactive application, then the default rule is to not apply that decision to cases that have completed direct review.
Well, today we're asked not to be silent, but to decide it one way or the other. And certainly we had prior cases affirming convictions that all got, and approving death sentences that all got overturned in Roper and LWOPs that got overturned in the 80-plus cases that were up here on habeas. Why aren't those applicable here? They may not be, but why aren't they?
Well, my understanding of those cases, Your Honor, is that the court did decide to apply them retroactively, whereas in the Bissell decision, there was no discussion of retroactivity.
So how do we make that decision here? How does that help inform our decision here today where that question's before us?
Well, I think Justice Breckinridge's point about the fact that the Bissell decision, if it applied retroactively, could affect over 12,000 offenders that are both incarcerated in the Department of Corrections and supervised by the Board of Probation and Parole. That should weigh heavily on this court's decision in retroactivity. I mean, the analogy to the Linklater-Stovall analysis and procedural rules of federal due process or federal rules of law.
If I understand your statement of law, it is that the court can decide retroactively there's an application retroactively of a substantive rule change, but is not compelled to, that it is within the discretion of the court depending on the circumstances in which to make that decision. Is that what you are telling us our prior cases would support?
That's correct, Your Honor. And Ferguson would support that when the court does not directly address that issue, then the default rules to not apply the case to cases which have completed direct review.
And Mr. Sauer, referred to Whitfield, which had to do with a judge rather than a jury imposing a death sentence when the jury hung. And one of the factors we considered there was that there were only half a dozen cases that would be affected by our decision.
Right, and that factor would be the effect on the orderly administration of justice, which would weigh heavily against retroactivity in this case, if that were the test that we were applying.
Is there a difference in the cases where, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court announced a new rule that the death penalty could not apply to juveniles, and a situation here where a statute is just interpreted differently?
There is a difference, Your Honor. In fact, federal jurisprudence has long held that state courts will determine the retroactive application of state decisions interpreting state law, whereas for federal decisions interpreting federal law and constitutional issues, there are different rules of retroactivity for that.
So then do you agree with the language from the Iowa Supreme Court?
I do, Your Honor. I think the language in Guzman is authoritative and quite on point for the Bazell issue here. When this court overrules prior authoritative judicial interpretations of law, it is, in essence, changing the law.
More so than clarifying.
Exactly.
So if there had been no Pasley decision, would your argument be different then, and you say, yes, it applies retroactively?
I think the argument would, of course, be different any time a fact has changed, but we would still argue that the other cases, Miller, Brown, Slocum, were all also authoritative interpretations of the statute, as well as this court's jury instructions and approved charges. In fact, Hawkins v. State, a decision from the Court of Appeals, has previously held that a court decision which is directly in conflict with Missouri approved charges does represent a change in the law. Now, I won't rehash the discussion we've had on the stealing over 500 issue. I think my colleague, Mr. Sauer, and the petitioners addressed that fully. I would just note that I would concur that from the plain reading, the plain language of the statute, the stealing over 500, or the element of value, is a necessary element in the crime of stealing over $500. And I think Judge Stith more than once pointed out that the Apprendi line of cases says that these enhancing factors have to be elements. And so the petitioners are in the unique bind where they have to admit that value is an element in this case under Apprendi, but then they have to come back and say that, well, under the legislature's reading or legislature's written words in the statute, it's not an element. But that would be inconsistent with Apprendi.
But that position is inconsistent with some of the language in Bazell, that the introductory phrase in subsection 3 is referencing subsection 1, which does not reference value.
Well, Your Honor, in Bazell, the court looked at both subsection 1 of 570.030 and subsection 3.3d, which was the any firearms provision. And I think the court looked at those sections together. They weren't looking at them in isolation, which, as we've discussed earlier, you don't look at sections of statutes in isolation. You do read them together. And when the court looked at both subsection 1, which reads that, you know, you commit the crime of stealing if you appropriate property or services of another without the consent, and then you look at 3.3d, which talks about any firearms, well, under a plain reading of that statute, value is not stated as an element. And if that case were submitted to the jury wouldn't have to find the value of the firearms in that case. Whereas here, these cases are very distinct from Bazell because value was required to be found by a jury and value was stated in the statute as a necessary element. There are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just get up to ask if there are any further questions. I can't imagine there isn't anything we haven't explored, but I want to leave on the table a little something for my colleague, Mr. Myers, so I will sit down unless there are any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Case will be submitted.